You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll return now to Pacifica radio host Ambrose Lane as he explores the compelling economic issues that he says were a major impetus for the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Now, unique to capitalism is the strange phenomenon of production falling because of the ability to produce too much. The further growth of production is held back not by physical limits to production like equipment, raw materials, and labor power, or by physical limits to consumption, even if needs for a particular commodity were completely satisfied. Investment could move to fulfilling other needs. Rather, production is held back by the fact that it is not profitable for the capitalist to produce more. It was only when we entered World War II and the needs of war created full employment of labor and industrial capacity that the United States really emerged from the Great Depression that began in 1929. And after the war, there were the needs of post-war rebuilding as well as pent-up demand for consumer goods postponed during the war. Then demand continued to be boosted by wars in Korea and Vietnam and the Cold War, requiring massive arms expenditures even in peacetime. Our economy came to rely for generating demand more and more on an explosion of debt, corporate debt, consumer debt, national debt, and on a financial speculative sector whose growth far outstripped the growth of commodity-producing sectors. The day of reckoning can be put off for some time with the help of state or government intervention, whether that's physical, fiscal, or financial. And the United States corporate profitability, it now emerges, turned dramatically downward in 1997 in the face of worldwide overcapacity. Between 1997 and 2000, at the very same time as the much-vaunted U.S. economic expansion was reaching its peak, corporate profits in absolute terms and the rate of return on capital stock, that is plant, equipment, and software, in the non-financial corporate economy were falling sharply, as recently revised figures show, by 15 to 20% in both cases. Despite these, share prices soared, fueled by cheaper and cheaper funds as the Federal Reserve repeatedly loosened interest rates. What took place was the biggest credit boom in U.S. history. The wealthy consumed more, finding the prices of their shares soaring. Corporations borrowed and bought back their shares, pushing up their share prices further and thus getting access to cheap funds. And with these funds, they made massive new investments. No doubt, profitability kept plummeting, but unscrupulous auditors were hired to dress up the books. Among the 27 major corporations so far found guilty of such practices are such stars as AOL, Time Warner, Enron, WorldCom, and Xerox. The two top United States banks, Citicorp and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as Merrill Lynch and the country's top auditing firm, Arthur Andersen, are also deeply implicated. In the words of The Economist magazine, this is the magazine of capitalists in Great Britain, in an article, September 28, 2002, "This is no normal business cycle, but the bursting of the biggest bubble in America's history. Never before have shares become so overvalued. Never before have so many people owned shares, and never before has every part of the economy invested in a new technology with such gusto, indeed overinvested. All this makes it likely that the hangover from the binge will last longer and be more widespread than is generally expected. The most recent bubble was not confined to the stock market," said The Economist. "Indeed, the whole economy became distorted. Firms overborrowed and overinvested on unrealistic expectations about future profits and the belief that the business cycle was dead. Consumers ran up huge debts, saved too little, believing that an ever-increasing stock market would boost their wealth. The boom became self-reinforcing as rising profit expectations pushed up share prices, which increased investment and consumer spending. Higher investment, a strong dollar, helped to hold down inflation and hence interest rates, fueling faster growth and higher share prices. I remember so well the run-up of Amazon.com. Here was a corporation that never had earned a single penny in profit. Yet its shares went from $40 to over $140 each. Never made a penny in profit. Now, the outcome has been catastrophic. This is what The Economist magazine says. Since March 2000, the Standard & Poor's 500 index, an index of share prices, has fallen by more than 40%. Some $7 trillion, trillion with a T, y'all, has been wiped off the value of American shares, equivalent to 2/3 of annual GDP. And yet share prices still look expensive. They will fall more, so said the Economist magazine. The theory of business cycles, to which the American establishment, including Alan Greenspan, subscribes, we have just described. But that says that overinvestment and high employment finally result in declining profitability, triggering a recession. Through the recession, the earlier excesses are purged, capacity is scrapped, and workers retrenched. Finally comes a point at which forces accumulate to reverse the downward direction, and it is profitable to invest again. However, by this standard theory, the recession should be nowhere near its end, since the earlier excesses are not being purged at all. Instead, the Federal Reserve's answer to the downturn is to pump in more debt. As The Economist, the London-based voice of capital, notes with concern, and I quote, "A good indication of the size of the adjustment yet to be made is the private sector's financial balance, or private sector net saving, equivalent to saving minus investment. In the United States, the private sector balance shifted from a surplus of 5% of GDP in 1992 to a deficit of 5% of GDP in 2000 as households and firms went on a borrowing spree. An astonishing change after almost four decades when the private sector never ran a deficit at all. Troublingly, consumers have continued to borrow as if little has changed. By slashing interest rates, the Fed has encouraged a house price boom that has partially offset equity losses and allowed households to take out bigger mortgages to prop up their spending. Households' debt service payments are close to a record high, even though interest rates are low. Households cannot keep borrowing at their current pace. At some stage, they will need to start saving more and spending less. If this happens abruptly, it will trigger another deeper recession," so said The Economist. Now, the American manufacturing sector has become increasingly unable to compete with imports. For every dollar of good it exports, the United States is now spending $1.43 on imports. It is running a monthly trade deficit of more than $40 billion a month, or nearly $500 billion a year. Some American commentators worry that the American manufacturing base is being whittled away, and smaller manufacturers in this country are pressing for a substantial devaluation of the dollar to make American goods cheaper than foreign goods and thus better able to compete. Of course, this solution is ruled out for the United States since it runs counter to the interests of the United States' global financial hegemony. We've had an endless supply of golden eggs as people have invested their money in America because of the dollar. Let me tell you what that's about quickly. During World War II, the Bretton Woods Conference worked out post-war international financial arrangements with the aim of ensuring the imperialist power's stability, providing for their growth, and avoiding the types of financial crises witnessed in the preceding decades. Among other things, the conference fixed the value of the United States dollar in gold at $35 an ounce. And holders of U.S. dollars could convert them into gold at their option. You remember Fort Knox? This posed no problem as long as no one wanted to do so. But from the mid-1960s, when inflation reduced the value of the dollar, foreign dollar holders began converting their dollars to gold. Alarmed at its declining gold supplies, our country first devalued the dollar relative to gold in 1971, and in 1973 unilaterally declared it would no longer be convertible into gold. If countries continued to accept the dollar as the currency for international payments, and investors continued to put their money in dollars, it was because of America's continuing supremacy worldwide and the absence of a competing international currency. U.S. control over oil producers played a crucial role. Oil exporters, led by Iran, Venezuela, and Saudi Arabia, decided to continue denominating the price of oil in U.S. dollars, a sign of confidence in the United States and in its money. But in fact, these countries had little choice but to continue to use U.S. dollars. There was simply no realistic global alternative at the time. With oil linked to the dollar and a substantial U.S. military presence in the Middle East, the position of the dollar seemed to be strong. At that time, Iran was the closest U.S. ally in the Persian Gulf. Remember the Shah of Iran? And welcomed U.S. military presence. Iran was also the most powerful military force and the most populous country in the region, as well as the world's second largest oil exporter. Now, to date, the oil-dollar link has given the United States a huge advantage in international trade. Corporations and countries carry out trade in U.S. dollars, making the U.S. Treasury and the U.S. Federal Reserve Board the ultimate arbiters of global monetary policy. However, the stability of the dollar, and by extension the global monetary system, partially depends on the financial policies of Persian Gulf countries that control nearly two-thirds of the world's reserve of black gold, that is, petroleum. That weakness became evident in 1979 when the Shah of Iran was overthrown by Ayatollah Khomeini's Islamic Revolution, and the United States lost its main military ally in the global oil patch. The price of oil shot up to $40 a barrel, and the value of the dollar plummeted relative to other currencies. The price of gold soared to $800 an ounce. The U.S. had to drastically increase interest rates to 15 to 20%, causing the most severe recession since World War II, in order to encourage foreigners to hold on to their dollars rather than dump them for other currencies. During those years, especially 1979, the end of Jimmy Carter's term of office, the ruling class alone benefited because they were able to buy U.S. bonds paying 15 to 20% interest for 30 to 40 years. And they only issued those bonds in $10,000 denominations. Now, Clinton's surplus, when he got ready to leave office, was beginning to retire these expensive U.S. debt instruments and to create surpluses as far as I could see. But then came George W. Bush. Now, let me sum up the points we've made. The United States, indeed the world economy, is suffering from a crisis of overproduction. In order to stave off recession, the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, has been boosting demand by pumping in unprecedented amounts of credit. We have the funds to do this because foreigners put their savings in U.S. dollar assets. Our overall global supremacy, in particular its control over oil, have sustained the United States status as the safest harbor for international money. However, the United States' ability to soak up the world's savings is a double-edged sword, because if foreigners who hold half or more of all the U.S. currency should decide to dump the dollar, its value would plummet, leading to yet more capital leaving the country. In order to prevent that from happening and to get foreign capital to return, the United States would have to raise its interest rate steeply. But if that were to be done, given the vast addition to our debt since 1980, this time around, a steep U.S. interest rate hike could cause a crash heard around the world. And this would happen because debt-laden American corporations and consumers would be unable to service their debts, so their assets would flood the market. Asset prices would collapse, and banks, swamped with worthless assets instead of income, would also collapse. In short, there's a threat of a new Great Depression. In the 1970s, there was no alternative to the dollar. But on January 1st, 1999, an alternative arose in the form of the euro, the new currency of the European Union. Of course, investors did not immediately flock to the euro. In fact, it stuttered at birth, falling 30% against the dollar by the end of 2000. But in the last year, it has picked up sharply. And in recent months, it has reached parity or exceeded the value of the dollar, now standing at 1.07 to the dollar's $1. Now, the euro has become attractive for three reasons. First, since the European Union is a large imperialist economy, it is an attractive and stable investment for foreign investors. Second, since foreign investors' holdings are overwhelmingly in dollars, they wish to diversify and thus reduce the risk of losses in case of a dollar decline. They are increasingly nervous at the size of the U.S. debt mountain and the failure of the U.S. government to tackle this problem. Certain countries smarting under American military domination sense that the rule of the dollar is now vulnerable and see the switch to the euro as a way to hit back. Thus, even in November 2000, when the euro was 30% down against the dollar, Iraq, Saddam Hussein, demanded U.S. approval to be paid in euros in the United Nations Oil for Food program. This, despite the fact that the currency markets at that time did not see a rebound for the euro, and despite the fact that Iraq would make the switch at considerable immediate cost, losing 10 cents a barrel to compensate buyers for their currency conversion costs. Iraq also asked that the $10 billion in its frozen bank account in New York be converted to euros. the United Nations, which has become a plaything of our government, resisted the change until Iraq threatened to suspend its oil exports. Now, Iran, which the U.S. has now labeled, along with Iraq and North Korea, as part of an axis of evil, is also contemplating switching to the euro. The Iran National Oil Company welcomed the launch of the euro in 1998 itself, saying that, quote, this money will free us from the rule of the dollar and we will adopt it. The National Oil Company and other major Iranian companies have made it clear to both their European and Latin American oil partners that they would prefer the euro. While Iran continued using the dollar thereafter, there are indications it could follow Iraq's example. Some in Saudi Arabia have called for switching to the euro as a more effective punishment than an oil embargo for the United States, Israel's principal source of financial and political support. Now, you know why Saudi Arabia has suddenly become an enemy. Now, another likely candidate for switching to the euro is Venezuela, whose leader, Hugo Chavez, the United States has been attempting to oust over the last year without success. It is not only the oil economies that would make the switch. For example, North Korea, too, recently said it would convert its foreign exchange reserves to the euro. But the shift of the major oil exporters to accepting payments in euros would indeed have a major, potentially devastating impact on the dollar. Now, we have not done anything to raise friendships throughout the world. Assuming rational collective behavior on the part of investors, far removed from reality, once the shift takes place, herd behavior takes over. Now, during this whole period, the United States has damaged its chances of cooperative action with Europe and East Asia by going on a rampage of unilateralism. Examples abound. It has dismissed the binding obligation of the Kyoto Protocol on climate change and thus thrust the burden of preventing global warming on the rest of the world. It has refused to be bound by the newly set up International Criminal Court. It has refused to sign the treaty banning anti-personnel mines. It has dumped the process of strengthening the Biological Weapons Convention. It has rejected the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which the previous U.S. administration was trying to force third world countries like India to sign, and is preparing to test a fresh generation of nuclear weapons, which it now calmly says it plans to use against non-nuclear countries as well. It has unilaterally withdrawn from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty and is racing to set up a space-based shield against missiles, the National Missile Defense, which will indeed enable it to strike others with nuclear weapons and not fear reprisal in their minds. It thus creates scope to seize control of outer space. It has openly threatened the United Nations that it would be rendered irrelevant if it did not follow American dictates. After extracting an unprecedented declaration from NATO that the September 11th attack on the U.S. would be treated as an attack on all NATO member states, U.S. ignored NATO for the Afghanistan invasion and assigned European forces only such lowly jobs as policing. In trade, the U.S. has leveled heavy tariffs on European steel imports in order to protect its own industry. It has unilaterally retaliated at what it sees as European restrictions on imports of American beef and bananas, each retaliation accounting for $100 million or so of annual trade, and has rejected all European efforts to resolve these disputes. Without sanction from any international body, the U.S. levels sanctions against European firms that deal with American enemies such as Cuba and Iran. Now, according to Fred Bergston of Foreign Affairs magazine, April 2001, more trade clashes loom. The world's biggest airplane makers, the American Boeing and the European Airbus, are fighting a frenzied battle for shrinking orders. In 2003, a dispute is set to explode over agricultural subsidies, genetically modified products, and overall agricultural trade. In short, this administration has made a mess of everything in the world. And as Jane Perlitz reported in the New York Times, June 27th, 2002, in an article entitled China Races to Replace U.S. as Economic Power in Asia, she said, in Asia, the threat to the United States could come from the increasing trend towards the setting up of an economic bloc on the lines of the European Union. China, Japan, South Korea, and the Southeast Asian countries are moving slowly towards an East Asian free trade area. South Korea, Indonesia, and Thailand have suffered the humiliation of begging for international monetary funds during the 1997-98 crisis. The loans were given on condition that they followed austerity measures that merely suppressed economic activities and made their firms cheap for American corporations to buy up. This experience spurred the moves to set up cooperative arrangements to prevent currency collapses and eventually establish an Asian monetary fund for these purposes. Since these countries have $1.5 trillion of foreign exchange reserves between them, the Asian monetary fund would rival the U.S.-dominated International Monetary Fund. These developments may move in the direction of a common currency at some point in the future. And the United States is strenuously attempting to prevent the emergence of such a separate bloc. It sees the growing integration of capitalist China with the Southeast Asian economies as an important threat. As a global recession sets in, with the U.S., Europe, and Japan sinking together, tensions are likely to sharpen between these three blocs, and cooperative effort to boost global demand is less likely than is competition among them to get the biggest share.
Ambrose Eileen Sr. is the producer and host of We Ourselves, which airs on Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C. We'll have the second part of his lecture entitled Epicenter of Evil on tomorrow's Peace Watch. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.